Welcome to the next episode of Sniffing the Pages. I am Nina Manning.
I'm Katie Griffiths.
And in this episode, we'll be discussing The Touching and Tender, If Only I Could Tell You by Hannah Beckerman, the stark and engrossing third novel by Anne Weisgerber, The Glovemaker. Katie will be telling us what else she's read this week in the aptly named feature, What Katie Read Next. And finally, I've been completely gripped this week by the most recent psychological thriller to hit the shelves, the second and most anticipated domestic noir novel, The Girl Next Door by Phoebe Morgan. And I will be chatting to Phoebe later on as well. So we're going to start with The Glovemaker by Anne Weisgerber.
In the inhospitable lands of the Utah Territory, during the winter of 1888, 37-year-old Deborah Tyler waits for her husband Samuel to return home from his travels as a wheelwright. It is now the depths of winter, Samuel is weeks overdue, and Deborah is getting worried. Deborah lives in Junction, a tiny town of seven Mormon families scattered along the floor of a canyon, and she earns her living by tending orchards and making work gloves. Isolated by the red rock cliffs that surround the town, she and her neighbours live apart from the outside world, even regarded with suspicion by the Mormon faithful who question the depth of their belief. When a desperate stranger who is pursued by a federal marshal shows up on her doorstep seeking refuge, it sets in motion a chain of events that will turn her life upside down. The man, a devout Mormon, is on the run from the US government, which has ruled the practice of polygamy to be a felony. Although Deborah is not devout and doesn't subscribe to polygamy, she is distrustful of non-Mormons with their long tradition of persecuting believers of her wider faith. But all is not what it seems, and when the marshal is critically injured, Deborah and her husband's best friend, Nels Anderson, are faced with life and death decisions that question their faith, humanity, and both of their futures.
It's a really quite long description.
Yeah, that was quite a detailed blurb.
So, just a little bit about the author. Anne is the author of The Glovemaker, The Promise, and The Personal History of Rachel Dupree. For Rachel Dupree, she was nominated for England's 2009 Orange Prize. I think that's called the Bailey's Prize now, and for the 2009 Orange Award for New Writers. In the United States, she won the Stephen Turner Award for New Fiction and the Langham Prize for American Historical Fiction. She was shortlisted for the Ohioana Book Award and was a Barnes & Noble Discover New Writer. For The Promise, Anne was shortlisted for the Walter Scott Prize for Historical Fiction and a finalist for the Spur Award for the Best Western Historical Fiction. She was also a finalist on the... A finalist for the Ohioana Book Award for Fiction. So, it's pretty, got a few accolades going on there.
Absolutely. It's a good book.
Yeah, I've never heard of her before, so it's the first time for me for an Anne Weisgerber novel.
Me too, but I would read another one.
Yeah, I think so, definitely.
That's a positive endorsement to start
with. Yeah. So, yeah, in the opening chapters... as we've just discussed there in the long blurb, Samuel is missing. And in the opening scene, it's Nell. And now I read this a couple of weeks back and I can't remember. Who is Nell with? I can't remember. Nell's.
I mean, I only read this last week, but I still can't remember. We can edit that. Carson Miller.
Sounds like a brand of beer.
He does. The two of them are out trying to see if they can see what's happened to Samuel, and they find that there's been a rock slide, and so they assume that he's had to go round a longer way back.
Yeah.
So that's sort of the opening scene, and then the next chapter opens on a few months later or a few weeks later.
Yeah.
When he should be arriving back any day if he's had to go the longer way round.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, it then cuts to Deborah in her cabin. And then it really sort of just kicks into the story straight away then, doesn't it? Because the knock comes at the door and that this is a stranger who's seeking refuge.
Yeah, so it's like there's a knock comes on the door and she knows it's trouble and it's not the first time that it's happened. And they've got sort of a procedure for how they help these people who are on the run from the US government because they're being prosecuted for... having multiple wives.
Yeah, that's it. Samuel and Deborah live in a dwelling, the aptly named Junction, as it's a sort of a spot on the way to the Floral Ranch on Pleasant Creek, which is an even deeper place into the canyons. That is a junction that's owned by a family 11 miles away. So you think that doesn't really sound very far, does it? But, you know, horseback and...
Yeah, and I think it got the impression that it's very inhospitable land, so it's not easy to travel. And that's sort of where people who are... So I think Floral Ranch is where people who are... yeah, fleeing because they've been prosecuted.
Yeah, so people are coming,
taken and hidden away, and there's
right. So yeah, so that's the that was a bit I sort of stumbled on. Just couldn't understand, were the wives going to meet them there, were they just running and that was where they were going to be hiding, because like you say,
yeah,
they were
it didn't really clarify, and I don't really know. It was quite vague about that, and I think that was on purpose, in that the idea is that Deborah doesn't know what happens once they get to Flora Ranch, and that's good for her, because the whole reason that she can protect herself is by not knowing very much, so that if anyone does come when the lawmen come, she can say she doesn't know, and that's truthful. I don't know where they go.
Yeah.
She can deny all knowledge. So, it is a bit vague about what actually happens when they get there.
And just saying that they would get into more trouble is because Samuel and Deborah are childless, aren't they? Whereas all the other families that live in Junction... I keep going to say the Junction. It's just Junction, isn't it?
Junction.
They've all got family, so they've got more... There's a higher risk for them, isn't there, if they take in fugitives?
Yeah, so Deborah and Samuel haven't been able to have kids, and Nels Anderson, who's the other one, who's their best friend, and he's also involved in helping. He's a single... Well, his wife's passed away, so he's a single man with no children either, so they're sort of perceived as the ones with the least to lose. So they're the ones who are, yeah, putting themselves at risk to help these people, because they're being persecuted by non-Mormons.
Yeah. Non-Mormons.
Well, so in the book it's referred to as Gentiles, isn't it?
Yes.
That's the Mormon word for non-Mormons.
Yeah, that's right, yeah. So she houses this stranger for the night, doesn't she? And then the next day sends him off to Nell's down the road at the first light. Then she has to run around covering up her tracks before the marshal arrives, which they all know that he's on his way. It's just the sort of protocol, isn't it?
Yeah, and I found it quite stressful because she is quite... I mean, it's well written in that it gives you a real sense of her sense of panic.
Yeah.
And so I think one of the reasons that from the start, this particular person, this particular stranger showing up is worse for her, is that Samuel's not there.
That's right.
So she's already on it. She's on her own. She's a woman alone, which at the time is, you know, 1888 is an a lot of perhaps slightly scary thing to be anyway. And then, yeah, she feels like she's handling this without support. And then there's this sense that it's somehow worse than others. So when this man shows up, he says that there are people following him, so she knows he's being pursued by the law quite closely. He's not sort of fled and they're not following him, they're going to show up on her doorstep imminently after he moves on. So there's that sense of her that panic, and it going round and round and round in her head, like, what am I going to say, how can I make sure there's no trace of him,
what have I got to do, tick off a list in her head.
And you really get into that mindset where you can see yourself thinking, like, your brain's just scattering over all the things, and you almost need to take a big deep breath and be like, right, no, I need to do this calmly. And it's done really well, because that's what she's doing. She's panicking, and then she's calming herself down, and then she's panicking again.
Yeah. The beginning really reminded me, there's a film called Incredulous Bastards by Quentin Tarantino. I don't know if you've seen that film. She's not really a bit of a film buff, but Chris has got that film on DVD, and so I've watched that with him. But it's just the way the pace and the threat kept building at the beginning. The opening scene... as we talked about, where Nels and Nels and Carson are looking... Is it Carson?
Yeah, Carson.
They're looking for Samuel. I could instantly visualise that as a film. You know, yeah, the sort of Utah mountains around them.
I think the scenery sounds really spectacular, and it's described almost as a part of the... It's almost a character in the book, the scenery and the inhospitable landscape, and how you have to... You know, you're working with it, or it's working against you, and you have to kind of, you know... If the weather's bad, you have to know when you have to let the weather win, effectively.
Yeah.
And it felt really sort of real, and you can really see it. And as you say, it's quite cinematic. It's described in quite a cinematic way.
Yeah, I did a little Google and Googled Utah, and automatically I'd already thought of another film, actually, called 127 Hours, where a guy is cycling. It's based on a true story, and he's cycling. It was actually filmed in the Utah territory there as well.
I feel like I've heard of this one.
And he falls between two, sort of a crevice.
I do remember this film.
He's trapped there for 127 hours and has to hack his own arm off with a blunt penknife.
Yeah, that's why I didn't see that. I remember that.
It's a really lovely film.
Yeah, charming.
Really short film, actually. But you know, so that I got a visual in my head of the mountains, because I thought, well, actually, yeah, I've seen that
being
film.
Really, the kind of place where that could happen, you know, a dangerous landscape, I think, is what. And that's clear as well in the way that they refer, you know, that fear that she's got for Samuel is that they keep, you know, both her and Nels, who's his best friend, is sort of told from both of their perspectives, as in they both have times when they're kind of the narrator of it, of the story. And both of them sort of keep telling themselves over and over, he knows it, you know, he knows it well, he knows the roads well, he knows the landscape well, he's been doing this his whole life, he's going to be okay. The things that you tell yourself over and over when you're terrified for someone.
Yeah, you have to imagine, partly you sort of imagine some terrible scenario, but part of you just weaves this whole story in your mind, well, they must have done this, and then that led to this, and then this has happened, and that's happened, and she does that, doesn't she?
Yeah, he was probably delayed here, or he could have been delayed doing this, and then the weather's been really bad, and he's had to come this really long way round over the really high mountains, it's going to be really slow, and he's sort of rationalising, but the whole book carries that sense of dread about what's happened to him, and where he is.
Yeah.
And that fear that they're both feeling for him.
And that carries it right through to the very end, because we don't find out until the very end
where he is and what's happened.
So when the marshal first arrives, which she does a little later, there was bits in the book that I thought were written really well and really gave me a sense of place. So when Deborah talks about how the cabin felt really narrow and small once all the marshals had arrived and they're inside there, you could imagine.
Yeah, once that big sort of presence is inside your bit, and I think that's, yeah, once someone you're scared of in particular is inside your space, how physically threatening that is, and how it makes your home seem small and, like, it's insignificant in comparison.
You can imagine them coming in with their big heavy boots.
Yeah, and you really got a sense of
and
that.
Big manly smells. And
and you got that sense of the fear that she carries, because being a Mormon is not accepted in some, you know, some of their practices are illegal. And there's that, you get the sense that they've been brought up with this fear that they could be, you know, the world wants to persecute them and wants to come after them and lock them up or get rid of them in some way. So that sort of sense of fear, and basically the whole book is kind of infused with that fear of different things, and it did feel quite oppressive and stressful in some senses to
and read. In that sense, that's why it was, for me, I felt like it was such a page turner, because I kept,
do you know,
just want to know, don't you?
Yeah, and when I thought back on it, I thought not a huge amount actually happens.
No.
And there were a few bits in it where I was sort of like, I'd quite like this to move on a bit now. But actually, I think the whole point of it is, yeah, that not a huge amount does happen, but it's all that, it's that fear and gathering dread that just builds and builds throughout it, both in relation to the stranger and then the marshal who follows him and that sort of storyline. And also, you know, in the background, there's this fear for Samuel that's going on as well. And that between those two things, yeah, they do grip you, because you want to know what's happening and what's going on. Even when you look back and think plotline wise, it's quite straightforward. It's not loads of twists and turns and slow reveals and convoluted sort of twisty plot. It's very, quite a nice straightforward linear plot, but it still gives you that sense of drama that you keeps
and you're
you
sort
reading.
Of stranded there, aren't you, almost with them. Feeling, like you say, that sort of sense of
starkness. And yeah, it's a sense of place that you get, that you almost feel that you're there, and you feel how oppressive it might be and how scary it is in winter and how isolated you are.
I imagine summer is very, very nice. There was parts of me there was times when I felt, actually, this is quite sort of the simplicity of it and the
I think that's it,
the idyllic kind of lifestyle in, you know, in 1888 where they were with all that snow and nothing to do except, you know, cook the venison and warm up the milk and sweep the floor. And I thought, oh, you know,
it does it's a very straightforward and
few
minimal
weeks of doing that because
it does sound quite a sort of very pleasant holiday.
But for them, obviously, you know, it probably
that's their
gets
life,
to the point
yeah.
where they don't know anything else, but it's all about waiting and hoping and you know, waiting for that letter to arrive, because there was no postal service as such, really. It was just a
yeah, so that's the other thing. She hasn't had any letters from him. And it's is that because something's happened to him, or is that because, yeah, the postal service relies on people going, you know, coming through Junction to bring post. The postman doesn't just rock up like he does.
Yeah.
I
really thought
like
about that bit a lot. You know, how would they get their post? How long was that going to take? for a letter to arrive.
Yeah, the isolation of it.
Yeah.
And I think it says it in the blurb, that's part of what's, it's clear that that's what's attracted these people to live there, is that it's isolated, because they feel they're not accepted by wider society, but they're also slightly outside of their own community. So the Mormon community doesn't think that they're devout enough, but they're still excluded by, you know, mainstream society. So they're this sort of like little group of outcasts, really, who have carved themselves a little space, and all they really want is to be left alone.
Yeah. It spurred me to do a bit more Googling, like we like to, and look into the history of the polygamy and that was practiced during the 19th century. So I really had no idea about the Mormons, but this book is based on them coming to Utah and settling around that period, isn't
and
it?
Yeah, so I would say it's
the very beginning of it all, wasn't it?
It's a historical novel in that it's based on, it's the plot line itself and the characters aren't necessarily real, but the situation hangs on historical fact. So the sort of some key historical things that are mentioned in the book, like them moving into Utah territory and how that goes, and key events that sort of inflame the antagonism between Mormons and non-Mormons are based on real things. Well, they are real things that actually did happen.
Mm.
So from that perspective, yeah, it's a historical novel. It's based on, it's a fiction hung on fact, if that makes sense.
Yeah, and to learn about the plural marriages, and there was a president, so only the church president held the keys authorising the performance of new plural marriages. So these plural wives occur at specific times when basically a man
they want to reward a man.
Another wife or two. So.
Yeah, and it's you have to be approved by a church elder.
Yeah.
Or whatever the words is to be allowed a second wife, and basically you could reward a man by giving him another woman.
So you know, there's no real rules involved here. It's just kind of
no, and you can sort of, you can see why in some ways it's very different to, I guess, what mainstream, broadly speaking, Christian society that America was at the time, still is technically, I suppose. And you can see why that seems, I guess it's a fear of something that's different, and you feel threatened by it, and that's why it's, they're so persecuted, because it's a fear of different.
But I certainly wouldn't think that any of the wives were particularly happy about it. In the book, Deborah flashes back to her past, doesn't she? And she recalls her father, when her father welcomed another woman into the family, didn't he?
Yeah, so I think it's sort of club, you know, it says again in the blurb that Deborah doesn't subscribe to polygamy and she's not devout. And I think that's because it's clear from flashbacks that that's because she saw as a child the effect on her mother.
Which was really sad. It was really written really, really sadly,
wasn't
it?
It seems really bleak. I mean, her mum was the one I felt really sorry for. Is that sort of
putting on that front, pretending everything was all right, smiley.
Yeah, and the wives are told that it guarantees them a sort of ascension to a, you know, so that when they die they go on to, they're guaranteed to go on to a better place because they've been blessed to be chosen to be in a polygamous relationship, and that's the reward for the wife. And it's like her mum just keeps telling herself this, my celestial rewards are going to come, and that's basically why I'm putting up with this shit. Mm. Which is, you know, it's hard when you think, in this day and age, you think, why would you?
Mm.
Why would you part with her?
Mm.
Can you imagine your husband just bringing home another wife and being like,
yeah,
she's just going to live next door, and I'm going to spend half of my time here, half of my time there. I'll have another family with her, and we'll just crack on like that.
And and because I've been with you the longest, the half time that I'm with you, I'm just going to be kind of, you know.
Yeah, and she's going to be new and different because she's younger than you, basically. Newer, and I've already been with you for quite a long time, so I'm a bit bored.
Yeah, that was quite hard to read. That
yeah, it's difficult, isn't it? It did seem like a structure that very much favoured the man.
Mm. There was lots of parts that I really enjoyed reading. I liked reading the sort of unspoken relationship that plays out between Nels and Deborah.
Invested in that. Yeah. I really did. Like, I really liked Nels. I just wanted things to go well for him. He seemed like such a nice character, and I really emotionally invested in his happiness.
He made it quite clear quite early on in the novel, his feelings towards Deborah, and then as the novel pans out, we get to feel a little bit more of what Deborah feels, and she feels something similar, but neither of them want to play on it because obviously the circumstances with Samuel.
Yeah, so this whole thing is just, yeah, it's a lot of repressed feelings and undercurrents going on, I think, is it's done really well, because you feel them. You feel the sort
Just standing a little bit too close to each other. It was like, ooh.
The weight of all the things that are going on said in the room that you can sort of really feel, yeah.
Yeah. And she put her hand on his or something for...
Yeah, that split second. Like,
because she's a glove maker, and that's the other thing. It's not really spoken about much in the book, isn't it? I mean, a couple of occasions.
No, I think I thought that was going to be more key, given the title.
Yeah. But they mention it a couple of times, don't they, when she's made some gloves for Nels and that's
yeah,
really,
and so for her, making gloves is a very personal thing, and that she makes them, you know, she wants them to be perfect, and I think she keeps a record of all the gloves that she's made and a bit of the fabric that, you know, the leather she's used for each person and the stitching, and that's kind of a like a documentation of the people that she's loved. And that's the thing that she's done for them. She's made them gloves, and she wants them to be perfect and, you know, made with love and really special. So yeah, you get a sense of that when she's talking about ones she's made for Nels, that there is a sense of there's something there. She obviously feels very deeply for him as a friend or whatever.
And the other part that I enjoyed reading, but actually it did upset me and bring a few tears to my eyes, was there's a part in the book where the Marshal's injured, so he's in the house with Deborah and she's tending to him. So yeah, I found that bit really sad, actually. And she's constantly seeking that clarification. She needs that space to think. So when she sees his darned socks and realises that he has a wife or a sister, he's this person that's been cared for by another woman. And then she uses that as a way to kind of justify what she's doing. You know, if she does these things for this Marshal, then Samuel's going to be okay.
Someone will be doing them for Samuel. And it's good, actually, because you say it's nicely done, because at the beginning, he's just this terrifying, imposing figure. Like, he comes into her house, he's this overbearing, overwhelming presence, and she's just scared of him. And he's her enemy, that's all she can see him as. And that, yeah, that darned sock, and her realising he's got a wife, he's got a family, he's got a life, really humanises him for her.
Mm.
And then, I think as it says, you know, it's about her sort of test of humanity, so it clearly would be easier for her if something were to happen to him, because he's bringing trouble to her and to her village, if you can call a collection of seven families a village. But equally, you know, that she can't let that happen, because he's a person, and she keeps thinking of his wife, and his wife is like her. She doesn't know where her husband is, and she doesn't know when he's coming home, and that, yeah.
He's off. He's a sales rep. He's off somewhere, isn't he?
Yeah. He's off
in the family saloon.
Yeah, yeah. And it's that, like, yeah, that connection that really makes it really real. And
It was quite life-affirming, that. I found that quite poignant, and I really sort of thought, actually,
and she's
fighting through it,
her fear, isn't she? So she's always kind of, she's scared, but she's going to do it anyway, because she's made this bargain with herself about Samuel, but also really because it's the right thing to do, because she can't actually see him suffer and not help him once she knows that he's a person and not just this figure of something, you know, this symbol of something she's scared of.
Yeah, and we'll refer to, I think it will become our code word. If we say, because we don't want to give any spoilers, so if we say that bit, and you'll know what I'm talking about all the time. So there's that bit during that period with the Marshal in her house, so that bit that happens. You know, I found that incredibly moving.
Yeah, the whole, it's really beautifully written and really affecting, yeah. It's actually, it's a book in a way that is more than the sum of its parts. I think if I described it to someone, I think I'd be hard. Maybe I'm not doing a good job even now. But you're hard pressed to sort of get across why it's so moving or what's so engaging about it, when it's hard to describe. I think I just have to say to people, just read it. Yeah. It's the best suggestion I can come to.
I don't often start and try and tell Chris about a book, because he's not a reader, but he'd always say, "Well, what are you reading?" And I'll just sort of give a rough idea of what I'm reading. But with this book, I was halfway through and I put it down. I thought, right,
gotta tell you what's going on. Yeah, no, it was fascinating as well, because it was a period of history I don't know anything about. A period of American history I don't know anything about, and it was people I didn't know, have not known anything about, so it was interesting from that perspective as well, in terms of learning about a different type of lifestyle or a different way of living.
I think it's fair to say as well that it's a tale of strength and compassion, and the strength of women and under those circumstances and the conditions that she was in. You know, these days you'd imagine, you know, we've got to get our phones and our Prosecco out and, you know, texting our mates, oh, I'm having a mare. But, you know.
Can you imagine?
She's there, she's on her own, you know, she's doing all this.
Yeah, that sense of fortitude. And, you know, it's surprisingly uplifting as a book for a book that feels so grim and full of dread throughout it. When I look back on it, I felt surprisingly positive about it, even though when I was reading it, I did feel quite stressed.
Yeah. Yes.
Yeah, good, basically.
Fantastic read. I gave it 4 stars out of 5.
Yeah, I think I did the same.
Great.
So yeah, solid 4 stars.
Loved it. So the second book we read is If Only I Could Tell You by Hannah Beckerman. Audrey's family has fallen apart. Her 2 grown-up daughters, Jess and Lily, are estranged, and her 2 teenage granddaughters have never been allowed to meet. A secret that echoes back 30 years has splintered the family in two, but is also the one thing keeping them connected. As tensions reach breaking point, the choice that one of them made all those years ago is about to surface. After years of secrets and silence, how can one broken family find their way back to each other? So, yeah, a bit about the author. Hannah Beckerman is an author, journalist, event chair and broadcaster. In the UK, she writes for The Observer, the FT Weekend, that's Financial Times, isn't it? Financial Times Weekend Magazine and The Sunday Express, and is a book critic on BBC Radio 2. She regularly chairs at literary events and panels across the UK and has judged numerous book prizes, including the Costa Book Awards. Before becoming a writer, Hannah was a TV and film producer, spending 15 years producing and commissioning documentaries about the arts, history and science, both in the UK and the US. She lives in London with her husband and daughter. So she is a mother, which makes sense why she wrote such a heart-wrenching novel.
Yeah, so well, family relationships.
So we've just finished mopping up our tears after reading this book, and where to begin, really?
Yeah, I mean, I did properly ugly cry. Not sort of like a few gentle dabs of the tears, having to put the book down and have a proper weep. It was... It's beautiful, but it's hard to read. I found it in places quite brutal.
I couldn't even...
Quite difficult to
read. I read the quote at the beginning, the Thomas Hardy quote.
Yeah, I was already...
bawled my eyes out.
And then cried before the first page.
And then put that down for a little while. So the book begins with an incident on the stairs between 2 sisters, Lily and Jess, which occurs at their family home. Lily, I think she's about 10 years old at this point, witnessed something, made her mind up, and then this incident causes a lifelong rift between the sisters, and this is an incident which carries the entire novel through to the very last pages. In a sense, I kind of get a sense of atonement by Ian McEwan in that sort of with that similar kind of beginning with a child who sees something she doesn't quite understand yet and makes her own mind up.
Yeah, and you don't find out in the book what she saw and what that was.
Mm.
So I think Lily was a bit older, and Jess...
Probably about 15, I think, was she? Lily's 15 or 16.
Lily's about 15 and Jess is about 10. And so it's this event. Lily sees something, or she's coming out of this room. She won't let Jess go in. And Jess obviously thinks one thing has happened. It's not necessarily what has happened. She's only 10, she's speculating, and Lily's seen what she's seen, and she carries that with her. And it's just, you know, it's what happened behind that door. Mm. What did she see? And that's not really revealed until really late on, I think you were saying, the last 60 pages of the novel. Mm. And that question, what is it she saw, really hangs over it and draws you in, and you need to know. Like, I properly needed to know. I was turning the pages. Come on.
Yeah. We can say that Audrey, the mother, has been diagnosed with terminal cancer, because that's revealed pretty early on in the book, isn't it? And so...
Yeah, and it's really the catalyst for what happens in as far as... she's diagnosed with this terminal cancer, and that's obviously got to a stage where it's going to...
Sounds really jolly so far, doesn't it?
Yeah, I mean, I'm not going to lie, it's a brilliant book, but it's not cheerful. It's not... It was hard to read, I found it difficult.
Mm.
In that it was emotionally difficult.
But I mean, people have to read it.
Oh, it's brilliant. I wouldn't say don't read it. I would just say read it with a box of tissues and when you're feeling emotionally strong.
Yeah.
Don't read it at a low point.
No, definitely not. So as you're saying, so Audrey, her greatest wish then is to get her two estranged daughters to basically love each other again, isn't it? That's the gist of the novel, and that's what.
Yeah, so the journey because she's been diagnosed with cancer, she wants to heal this rift that's been tearing her family apart for 30 years. And both Lily and Jess, you know that their mum is dying. And I guess that makes them both look back on their past and think about what happened. And so there's a lot of flashbacks that gradually, slowly reveal what happened all those years ago. And then the flashbacks are from different perspectives as well. So you get to see what one person thinks happened, what another person saw.
Mm.
You know, bearing in mind that the girls are both very young. I mean, even 15, it's still young.
Mm. Yeah.
And you can't, you know, you don't view things through an adult lens necessarily at that age. But it's beautifully written. I mean, the themes, I guess, are just your family relationships, but also, yeah, what can happen if you don't, if you're not honest, or if you keep secrets, or if you don't, yeah, if you're not
don't
open and honest,
say how you're feeling.
Yeah, and if you don't just say what's happening
for the last 30 years.
If you don't at the time say, you know, particularly as a child, you're not necessarily going to, but you know, what are the repercussions if a child sees something they don't understand?
But Lily does try very hard. It appears through the book to me. She tries hard, doesn't she, on many occasions to try and contact her sister.
Yeah, I think she tries to reach. So it's clear from the beginning that Jess is the one who's maintaining the rift. So Lily doesn't really understand why her sister won't speak to her. She's tried to reach out to her. She's trying to understand. And she's tried that a lot. I think probably by the time that we've reached this point in the book, she's maybe given up. She stopped trying to reach out in the same way. But she's been trying to do this all along, whereas Jess has just made a decision to completely cut her out of her life. Won't be in a room with her, won't see her, won't let her daughter see her niece. Won't let her daughter see her cousin, if that makes sense.
Yeah, because of the high level of emotion through the book, she sort of drip feeds you the reveals throughout, because obviously you just don't want to be traumatised with that much emotional
trauma. You just be crying.
So it reads really well. It's like a highly emotive novel with complex family sagas interwoven.
Yeah, and so both Jess and Lily have got daughters as well, and they're both 17, so they both happen to have daughters at a very similar age.
So they've got their own thing going on.
Yeah, so there's you know, they've both got their own relationship with their mum and then their daughters, and there's I guess you see some of the kind of echoes or repercussions of what happened in their relationships with their daughters and how they managed it. And they've obviously both got, well, they had, you know, their children have got fathers, and their relationships with them variously as well. And that is, yeah, it's sort of, everything is related to the aftershocks
it
of
does,
what happened
yeah.
in that summer when they were young.
Specifically, Lily and her husband and their relationship, that has quite an impact.
Yeah, so that's
been
examined a bit more closely in the book.
Yeah, and it makes you realise that all these incidents, they all stem from childhood. Everything that you bring from your childhood can be carried through into your adult life. And that, I think that's
played
out well in the book.
Yeah, if you don't address those issues, that they will have effects on your existing relationships, whether or not you think that's happening. If you don't bring everything out into the open, it will be affecting how you live your life and how you form relationships, how you maintain them.
And that's clearly happened with Jess in the book, because she is no longer with her partner. And that's clearly because of...
Yeah, I mean, she's closed herself off from
saw or didn't see and didn't speak about when she was a child.
Yeah, and that trauma that she's carried with her that whole length of time. And I think the main thing for me, it was really about how you handle grief. Not necessarily grief, but the aftermath of a trauma. So grief is... specifically relates to, I guess, one thing, but yeah, how you handle something traumatic happening as a mum who's got children and as a child, and how if it's not all out in the open, how deeply it can affect people's lives.
Mm.
And I think when you look back, you just think, imagine if they'd all said what they thought happened, and they'd all talk about what did happen, and how different would their lives have been, what different paths they would have taken.
Yeah. Yeah, it makes you think that definitely the last few pages that's exactly what you think to yourself.
Yeah.
Just... Well, if this had been brought out in the beginning,
yeah,
everybody's lives would have been. But yeah, this is what happens in families.
Well, that's
across
exactly
the globe
it. This is
all
to
the
people,
time.
Is these things, these sorts of things, do happen
because we're very complex creatures, humans,
and particularly
sometimes
children
don't know how to talk about our feelings.
Yeah, particularly children who might see things they don't understand. They may not even have the words to say, you know, it's hard for a 10-year-old to see something, to even vocalise what they think they saw. There might not even really be words for what went on.
Yeah.
It's a big thing to have to do even as an adult, to sort of vocalise your feelings, and it's not easy.
And as you said, as a mother, reading this book, it was particularly hard, as we'll talk about that bit in the book, which we won't say, to spoil it, but... yeah, there was points when I just couldn't read it and I had to keep putting it down. I think I managed like maybe sort of two sentences and then had to keep stopping.
Yeah,
but
I mean,
just
it's
as
very
a mum with a daughter.
Places. I think, yeah, because the whole book is about mother-daughter relationships. And it is really hard to read because it is just very, it's beautifully written and it's deeply emotional.
Sorry, just and you can't moving help. The microphone there if you heard that squeak. It's not a mouse in the room.
Yeah, if there was a mouse in the room, you'd hear me doing all the squeak. Yeah, it's like, I guess, yeah. You feel it when you are, I guess if you are a mum, you can connect to that very easily on an emotional level. But I think anyone reading this would find it sad. I don't think
so.
It's limited to mothers of daughters.
I think definitely themes of grief and death and goodbyes and all those things, it definitely evoked so many feelings into me. It's the sort of book my husband, actually, when I've read books similar to this in the past, he would question and say, why are you reading, you know, something like that? It's going to make
you
so
cry that
sad.
Much, yeah.
But I think...
It's a good question.
I felt definitely at the end that I was completely unaware of the intricacies of the structure of the book. And I think that's really good when you get to that point when you're not reading it like a book. It's just flowing.
Oh, yeah, you're just
specifically
in
those final
yeah,
chapters.
Absolutely.
The writing was absolutely seamless. And I think Hannah, in this case, it was almost like she was being pulled along rather than sort of... It was just like it was being written.
Yeah, the story. You can feel the story like almost coming out of her.
Yeah.
Like the story is just taking you with it. And I think one of the things I think we haven't said, but it's clear, it's mentioned very early on, so I don't think it's a spoiler to say, you can edit this out if it is, that their dad has died.
So that
their dad dying wasn't the incident on this day behind this door.
Yeah, he's not there, he's
not
long
after. So there's obviously
Audrey.
The grief they're all carrying.
Audrey's husband.
Yes, so yeah. Mm. So they're obviously all carrying the grief for their dad / husband.
Yeah, we need to talk about Audrey because I actually tweeted, I was about a quarter of the way book into the book and I tweeted Hannah and I said, I'm absolutely in love with Audrey, I hope that's okay. She tweeted back, she said something like she couldn't have been more thrilled, but she was just that sort of character that you just can't help but fall in love with.
Yeah, so also there's another thing we haven't even really spoken about, is that she's handling this diagnosis of terminal cancer. That's also incredibly sad.
Like an absolute trooper.
And, you know, her daughters are... You know, there's not only all these resonances and issues coming back out of the past, but there's the realisation for both of them that their mum's not going to be there very much longer. And I also find that very hard to read because I'm really close with my mum. There's bits of that where I was like, oh!
Yeah.
You know, there were parts in that that made me cry.
Yeah.
And what I love about it is that she's trying to fix this rift in her family, but she's also, she's going out and doing things.
Yeah.
She's trying new things.
Yeah.
With these last, you know, year or so, or months, years of her life.
Yeah.
She's decided to go and, grab life.
There was
and experience
a moment when
things,
she...
and it's just, it's beautiful,
it's
and
like
it's inspiring, it's amazing.
So visual. There was a moment where she goes out onto stage and she sings that solo and I just felt like a film moment.
Yeah,
like it was
goosebumps
like,
all that. Yeah. All goosebumps.
It was like brassed off or something, that film. And just everyone's standing, you could just everyone.
Yeah,
like,
I had really had tears in my eyes then as well. Like, but that was sort of happy tears, like really kind of, wow, that's amazing.
And that was written so well because it took Audrey a few minutes or moments to realise, you know, what was happening. Everyone was applauding her. She'd finished her solo. And
it was magic. I loved it.
Yeah, it had... pretty much everything, didn't it? Lovable characters, twists and secrets, which are revealed bit by bit, and then that kind of beautifully written, heart-wrenching elements of the book as well. Yeah, I don't like to keep using that word heart-wrenching over and over again. It sounds a bit wanky, really, but I think you have to kind
of
have
the
box of tissues ready for
it. Yeah, it's difficult because it's the kind of thing that they'll that'll be put on the top of the front of the book as a soundbite. It feels like a marketing term, but in this sense, genuinely, it was heart-wrenching.
But I think
my heart was literally wrenched.
Would you kind of say that there's something to be said for reading a book like this that just draws all these emotions out of you?
Yeah, it's cathartic in some sense. I mean, you know, you have a big cry, and I think it does make you realise, yeah, the important, you know, what the important things are. You want to... I don't know, I wanted to finish it and go and hug my daughter really tight and ring my mum and tell her that I loved her.
Yeah.
You know, it does make you reevaluate the importance of those relationships. And that's, you know, that's powerful writing to do that for you.
Yeah, I haven't read a book that's made me cry that much since it's a book called A Song for Izzy Bradley.
I haven't read that, but I have heard of it.
By Caris, I think Caris or Caris Bray. So that was 2014, so that's what, a good 4 or 5 years ago.
I think I've got that actually, and someone warned me it would really make me cry, and I, at the time... is it 2014? Yeah, so my daughter was born in 2014 and I was a bit of an emotional wreck for that first 6 months, and I think I put it away like, I will read this when I'm not crying because I dropped a tissue, let alone because of a, because of a book.
So I've got a bit of a leaky nipple, I can't
exactly
actually.
I need to be slightly more emotionally stable to attack this book, because I haven't actually read it yet.
Yeah.
But yes, that sort of thing.
Yeah. So everything that I've seen, review wise, she's getting absolute rave reviews for this book, and she seems like a really nice lady, and I wish her all the luck with it because it was a fantastic.
Yeah, you know, it's brilliant. It's a really good book. Well done, basically.
Yeah, well done, Hannah,
for writing such a beautiful book.
I gave it 5 stars because I tell you what, it was only in my, up until I would say the last 60 pages, just before the last 60 pages, it was a 4. And then what she did to me.
Yeah, I agree. Yeah.
What Hannah did to me in those last 60 pages.
I think I would have to give it 5 as well. Because of how deeply it made me feel.
Yeah.
Like I say, it's hard in some ways to give a 5 to a book that you almost didn't enjoy in places because it was so hard to read emotionally. But I think a book that can make you feel that emotionally strongly and deeply is something special. So
yeah, definitely.
Read it, but yeah, not if you maybe have just had a baby and you're feeling really emotional. Yeah. I wouldn't have read it if I was in 2014, me.
Yeah. Great. 5 stars.
Yeah, but... 5 stars. Take tissues.
So next, Katie is going to talk to us about the book that she has been reading in the section that we like to call What Katie Read Next.
So this week, or 2 weeks, I'm going to talk about The Familiars by Stacey Halls, which came out except 7th of Feb in hardback. And I'll read the blurb and then I'll talk a little bit about what I thought about it. So it says, to have a child, she will trust a stranger. To protect a secret, she must risk her life. The Lancashire 1612, Fleetwood Shuttleworth is 17 years old, married and pregnant for the 4th time. But as mistress of Gawthorpe Hall, she still has no living child, and her husband Richard is anxious for an heir. When Fleetwood finds a letter she isn't supposed to read from the doctor who delivered her 3rd stillbirth, she's dealt the crushing blow that she will not survive another pregnancy. Then she crosses paths by chance with Alice Gray, a young midwife. Alice promises to help her give birth to a healthy baby and to prove the physician wrong. As Alice is drawn into the witchcraft accusations that are sweeping the northwest, Fleetwood risks everything by trying to help her. But is there more to Alice than meets the eye? Soon the two women's lives will become inextricably bound together as the legendary Pendle witch trials approach and Fleetwood's stomach continues to grow. Time is running out and both their lives are at stake. Only they know the truth and only they can save each other. A dramatic blurb.
Ooh,
So this is great. It was it's a historical novel. It's set, as I say, in the 1600s and it's about the Pendle witch trials. And I thought it was fascinating. It's a period of history I really knew nothing about at all. It was really interesting from that perspective. It's really well written. I really like the characters. Both Fleetwood is a really sympathetic character. I think reading that again, actually, that blurb.
She's so young, isn't she?
Yeah, I think that just really hit me again, actually, how young she is. So she's 17.
And she... Because I've read a little... I'm about 6 chapters in. But she was about 14 when she got with her husband.
Yeah,
and he's considerably older than her, so...
Yeah, so he's a lot older. You know, she's had these repeated miscarriages. It's really taking its toll on her body, probably because she's only 17.
Yeah, right.
That's very young to be having your 4th pregnancy.
Well, she was probably only 14 or 50 when she started...
Yeah, absolutely.
...childbearing, wasn't she?
You know, and she comes across Alice, and Alice says that she can save her, or she can help her. But Alice is caught up in accusations of witchcraft, which are obviously very serious accusations at the time. And there's this yeah, the Pendle witch trials, which are obviously notorious and well-known witch trials that were particularly, I think at the time they were the biggest ones that had ever taken place. And it's, you know, it's driven by this neighbour of Fleetwood's who's pushing for power, basically. It's a man who wants to take people, who's got some power and he wants more. And he's using the witch trials as a way of sort of gaining approval from those higher up than him, going all the way up to the king. So he's really got an agenda and a mission, and he's pushing this. He wants to find people, you know. You know that you sort of read things and hear things about how they used to dunk witches, and, you know, how it's basically a win-win, a lose-lose situation. Either you drown, if you were innocent, or you live and you were a witch, now they're going to kill you anyway. Yeah. So it's that, it's really about that, the fear that sort of brings. But basically it's about their relationship, and it's about Fleetwood finding her strength, I think. That book, it's about her finding what will she fight for.
Another sort of girl power book.
It is, actually, because it's a time, you know, it's a time, it is a time when women didn't have any power, really. You know, you were married off extremely young, and you were the property of your husband, and your job was to provide heirs for your husband, and if you didn't do that, you were a defective wife, effectively. And yeah, it's really about her finding her voice and her strength and her power at that time. And it's a really good book. Yeah, I really enjoyed it. I think I gave it 4 stars. And I won't say too much, because I know you're in the middle of reading it, so I don't want to give anything away.
No, but I'm very excited to read it. Thank you very much.
So now we arrive at my favourite part of the show, where I get to talk Griplett. I was lucky enough to receive an early copy of The Girl Next Door, the highly anticipated second psychological thriller by Phoebe Morgan. Phoebe Morgan is an author and editor. She studied English at Leeds University, has previously worked as a journalist, and now edits books as well as writing her own books. Her debut novel, The Dollhouse, became a bestseller, topping the iBooks charts at number 1 and the Amazon charts at number 35. The Girl Next Door is Phoebe's second novel and is out in paperback today. So welcome to the pages, Phoebe, and happy publication day.
Oh, thank you. And thank you so much for having me on the podcast.
You must be thrilled.
Yeah, I'm excited. I think I, probably like a lot of writers, I never really thought that I would even get one book published. So to have 2 published is really lovely. And I do feel really lucky. But today is, I think, a bit of a whirlwind. I'm just trying to sort of take deep breaths and keep calm throughout the day.
Well, thank you so much for joining us on your special publication day.
Oh, no,
good. I just want to give the listeners just a little teaser into the book. So here I go. Perfect mother, perfect wife. Jane Goodwin has spent years building her picture-perfect life in the quiet village of Ashton. So when 16-year-old Claire Edwards is found murdered in Sorrow's Meadow, Jane knows she must first protect her family. Every marriage has a few white lies, and hers is no exception. Jane's worked hard to cover up her dark secret from all those years ago, and she'll do anything to keep it hidden. So that's the blurb of the book for The Girl Next Door. So this is your second book and the second in a psychological thriller genre. So do you feel, Phoebe, this is now your comfort genre, or do you sort of have any ambitions to veer off into other areas?
Well, I would say it probably is my comfort genre now, mainly because I read the most in this genre. So for my day job, I work at a publishing house, and I publish a lot of books in the psychological suspense genre and the crime genre. And it's naturally what I would pick up anyway. So I love reading them in my spare time. So I think when I came to writing a book, I thought, oh, you know, I'll write something that I personally would like to read. So that's what initially drew me to the genre. And I've got a third one coming out next year, which will be the same sort of thing. And then after that, I'm not really sure. I've been thinking recently about maybe trying something a little bit different. I've always wanted to write short stories, but they'll probably never see the light of day. but I think, yeah, in the future, I might try and explore something else, just kind of just for myself, maybe just for fun. We'll see if anyone actually reads it. But I think for me, I do enjoy writing crime, and I like that kind of twisty characters, and I like sort of playing with the reader's emotions as they go through the book. So it's definitely something that I do really enjoy. And like I said, there are so many amazing writers in that genre, that it's something that I do really love to read, even when I haven't got to read it for work.
Yeah. So would it be fair to say, even though we've discussed it as a psychological thriller, it was quite early to say that word, psychological thriller, that we could say it's a sort of domestic noir type novel? That's another phrase
Yeah.
around a bit, isn't it?
It does, yeah. I would say so, because it's kind of really rooted in the domestic. So Ashton is a really small place in Essex. It is actually a real place, but it's not the same as it is in real life. I've just sort of lifted the name. But you know, so it's a really small community, and a lot of what goes on is kind of happening behind closed doors, and it's sort of about the ins and outs of people's domestic lives that you might not necessarily see from the outside. So I would say it's definitely kind of rooted in the home and the family and marriage and all the kind of secrets and lies that can go on in quite a small community. And that's something that I was really interested in and wanted to explore with the book. So I think the word domestic noir is really appropriate for this. Yeah.
So I think you've already answered the question about your motives writing psychological thrillers. It's a personal preference for you. You enjoy reading that genre. And so it was something that spurred you on to start writing in that genre as well.
Yeah, definitely. I think because, you know, it's really inspiring to work with so many amazing authors that do publish this genre. And, you know, it is also a really popular genre. You know, I'm very aware of the market because of my job. So I think when I was first writing The Dollhouse, you know, me and my agent had a bit of a discussion about, you know, whether we should kind of push it more in the psych suspense direction in order to make it fit the market better. So that's what we did for The Dollhouse. So that started off as like slightly lighter than it ended up. It ended up being quite dark. And then once we started the editorial process, I found that I really enjoyed it. And so then for the second book, it was always going to be a psychological thriller. But, you know, the market does move, and I think it's becoming like a very saturated genre. There's a lot of writers writing in this space, and I know that. But I'm kind of always of the belief that there is room for everybody. You know, as long as people are reading it, then, you know, there's enough room for different writers writing in the same space. But that said, you know, I think as a publisher, I'm aware that there is a bit of a shift, you know, away from it, especially in some territories, just because, I suppose, you know, there are just so many, so people sort of are always looking for the next thing. So I'll have to see what the market does over the next few years. But as long as they continue to sell, and as long as people continue to like my writing, then I'm happy to kind of continue in that space for a little while.
Yeah. And when you write, and when you're creating your characters, do you find that people might sort of say to you later on, oh, that character where you wrote her like this, that wasn't, you know, that wasn't me, was it?
Oh god, yeah,
maybe recognize
people do say that, yeah. Yeah, I think my family get really worried about that, but they're never based on real people. I think what I do, and a lot of other writers do, is take little snippets from real people, or maybe people that you don't even know, but someone that you might sort of see, or you might hear their voice, or you might think they've got a particularly interesting turn of phrase, and I'll kind of jot things down in the notes app on my iPhone, and then I'll, you know, go back to them and think, oh, how could I use that in a story, you know, how could I add this to a character. And so the characters end up being sort of kind of really multi-layered, and, you know, brought inspiration in from quite a lot of different places. They're never based on one real life person.
Yeah.
Because, yeah, I think I'd get in trouble if I just started writing real people.
Absolutely.
But it is something people do worry about.
They do
about,
don't they? I think in that genre, it's sort of like, oh, you know, it's quite dark and
Or the other thing people think is that it's sort of my life, and they, you know, I think they think, oh god, you know, it's this all from her personal experience, which it never is, you know, it's just the imagination. I do find it quite funny when people say that.
Yeah, because the truth is that you actually have to go off and get yourself into a particular mindset to write this, don't you? It all just comes from the darkest depths of your imagination. So do you find that when you're writing those really dark themes, such as child murder, I mean, they're particularly hard to write, or does it just come out quite easily?
I'm that's worried awful, I sound like a psycho.
You write murder quite easily.
I probably do write them quite easily. The things that I find hardest when writing are the sort of police elements of the book. So in The Girl Next Door, there's a lot more kind of what I would call police procedural elements than there is in The Dollhouse. And that was something I struggled with a bit because, you know, I'm not a police officer. Well, yeah. I've never been, but, you know, I don't have that first-hand experience. So I did talk to a couple of ex-police officers who helped me out with some queries, which was really kind of them. But I'm sure there are still, you know, a lot of inaccuracies if someone was reading it, you know, as an actual police officer themselves. But the thing is, you've got to kind of take a bit of artistic license, I think, and you've got to be able to speed up the investigation and, you know, make things happen at certain times for dramatic effect. But I think it is quite difficult to, you know, really get your head around what the realities of a police investigation, especially a murder investigation, would be like without having that first-hand experience. So yeah, I think I write murder quite easily, but the police section is a bit hard.
So was there one particular police officer that you've badgered quite a lot, or do you have somebody that you know that's was there a lot of Googling?
There was some Googling, yeah. There's a writer called Caroline Mitchell who was really kind and helpful to me. I sort of Facebook messaged her a couple of times, and a few other people that I had sort of just found through friends of friends. And I also spoke to a doctor who was helpful in terms of, you know, what would happen to a body, you know, if they died at this point in time. There's all those little things that I probably didn't think of when I started writing. And then I realised, oh no, I need to get all these things right. You know, they've got to be relatively accurate or else readers will notice, because readers are very eagle-eyed these days, so they quite, you know, they pick up on any kind of things which just are wildly inaccurate. So I try and keep them relatively accurate as far as I can.
Well, I read the book obviously, and it came through fine for me. I
didn't sense
anything wrong with it at all, so that was good.
Thank you.
So when you're actually plotting your novels, what comes first? Do you conjure up the titles, the scenes? Is it just a phrase, or what comes first to mind when you start writing?
So when I start, I usually begin with an idea. So it might be quite a sort of the gem of an idea rather than something that's fully formed. And I'm not really a huge plotter in advance. So quite often I'll just start writing and see where the story takes me. And then as I go, I'll start sort of plotting, you know, kind of along the way. For my third book, I'm just looking at my wall, which has got loads of post-it notes on, because for the third book, I've tried to plot it slightly better, because what's happened with the first two is that I'll write a first draft, and then I sort of end up rewriting it a few times, you know, because I sort of did it as I went along. And a lot of writers do work like that. I think it just depends what works for you. And sometimes I'll have a character in my head. So for The Girl Next Door, I had the character of Jane, who's one of the main characters, in my head to begin with. So I wanted her voice to be sort of the main narrative voice. And I knew little bits about her background, and I knew how the book would end. So quite often I know the ending, and it's just working out how to get there. So the middle section is something that I don't necessarily know how it's going to go until I'm writing it.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah, well, as I said before, I loved it. I really love the psychological thriller genre. That's one of my favourite genres at the moment. And I felt that was the perfect amount of threat and believability. And when you talk about Jane, the character, there's so many sort of unsettling things about all the characters in the book, and it just keeps you on edge all the way through. So it's done really, really well.
I'm really glad to hear that.
Yeah, I loved it. So you talked about your structure and how you write. So as an editor, and taking yourself out of your writer's shoes and into the editor's shoes, what are some of the common pitfalls you see in other writers when you're editing work?
I think repetition is quite a sort of pitfall that a few people fall into, and I think I do as well. So it can be quite difficult when you're writing in this genre not to kind of, you know, I think because a lot of the books focus on kind of delaying secrets and holding things back, it can sometimes take too long to get there. So you end up sort of repeating things that the reader might already know.
Right.
So that's something that I sometimes work on with authors, and just trying to, and I suppose that ties into pacing. So just making sure that it's, you know, it's not repetitive, it's not slow, and that the pacing is really, you know, is really on it, because I think in this genre people have come to expect real page turners.
That's,
you know, they're pitched as page turners. So it's about making sure that each chapter, you know, opens and closes with something that makes the reader want to continue. And pacing can be quite difficult, and often it's something that you might go back and add in later. You know, I quite often will go back through a manuscript and point out places where an author could, you know, up the pace or sort of cut out a little bit to help increase the tension, because I think that's such a crucial thing in this sort of thriller. And there'll be lots of, I've worked with authors where their plots are amazing and the characters are great, but for some reason it's just sort of the pace is dragging a little bit. You know, but usually it's very fixable. And I think it's just about identifying those places where it needs work for the writer, because when you're writing, you get, you know, you've read your manuscript so many times that's why you need an editor, I think, because you need someone to come in with that fresh pair of eyes.
Yeah.
And you need someone to be able to pick up on things that you, you know, understandably wouldn't be able to see because you've just spent so long with it. I mean, like, I'm absolutely sick of reading all of my books. Like,
yeah.
You know, I've read them so many times that I find them, like, really boring to read now.
Yeah.
And so I think, yeah, that's why, you know, and I'm lucky to have an editor as well, you know, who can look at it with a fresh eye, really.
Yeah. So I've been reading a few quotes on Twitter recently about writers that have gone back and read their own work for fun. So you're not quite at that stage yet.
Because no,
you're probably not ready to go back.
I don't think I'll ever get, I don't know. I can't imagine doing that. No, I mean, I read them to sort of check things, and I'm, you know, I'm writing this third one now and it's nearly finished. So I'm reading that a lot to check it through.
Yeah.
But the first two, no, I can't read it. I don't really want to read them again. And also I'm worried that I'll spot something. You know, I'm worried there'll be like a massive typo that we've all missed. And so I sort of prefer just to look at them on the shelf and not actually open them.
Yeah. Do you believe in the saying that a book is never actually ever finished? But I suppose because as you grow as a person and as a writer and as you evolve and you go back, you'll always sort of look back on your previous work and think, oh, I wish I'd done that, or I wish I'd done this. But actually you're a different person now, so you're probably always going to have those nagging thoughts.
Niggles. Yeah, I think I'm quite good at letting go of the manuscript, I think because of my job. So I, you know, I send a lot of books to production, you know, I sort of, you know, draw the line under books all the time, so I get used to that process. But you know, yeah, you're right, like I can look back at The Dollhouse and think, oh god, you know, that bit's really clunky and, you know, that bit should be different, but I can't, because I can't do anything about it. You know, I think at that point in my life it was finished. You know, I felt like I put 100% into it. You know, I did the best that I could, so that sort of has to be good enough, I think.
Yeah.
And you have to allow yourself to let go of the book and, you know, let it go out into the world, and because otherwise you'll drive yourself mad. You know, there's always one more thing you could have done. Or and with the third book, like before I send it to my editor, you know, I'm sure I'll be sort of fiddling and, you know, just changing this little thing before I send it. But at some point you have to just press send. You know, you have to let it go and see what other people think of it, or else you'll just, yeah, you'd be there forever trying to think of what you could have done better.
Yeah. So we live in an era where social media is really vital in spreading the news for everything. And so how do you think that's serving as a tool for you as a writer right now?
Well, I really like social media.
Other than a big distraction.
It is distracting. But I mean, I like it. I like being able to connect with people. I've met a lot of readers, you know, through social media, and I've had a lot of really lovely messages about the book. And I think without, you know, I use Twitter probably the most, and without that, I wouldn't be able to get those messages. You know, I wouldn't really have as clear an idea of how the book is being received. Obviously, you've got your Amazon reviews and, you know, people can tell you in person, but I think having those sort of little messages when someone says, oh, I saw your book the other day and, you know, I really enjoyed it, it really does make an author's day. So I think social media is great for connecting to readers in that way. And I also think it's great for connecting with other writers. So I've met a lot of other authors through social media, and, you know, a lot of them are now friends in real life. So I think, again, without that, it would be much harder to connect with writers because, you know, a lot of them are geographically, you know, don't live very close to me. But because we've met and interacted through social media, we can, you know, share the anxieties, you know, of publication, of the writing process. And that can really help, because when you're writing, it can be quite lonely. You know, you're sort of just sitting there typing away on your laptop. You've got no idea whether it's any good or not.
Yeah.
So to have other people that are sharing that experience can really help, you know, mentally. So yeah, on the whole, I'm a fan of social media, although I do think, you know, I do understand why people choose not to use it and why it can be quite overwhelming. There are negatives, I think. It's quite difficult as a writer not to compare yourself to other writers. So there's, you know, everyone's making so much noise on social media, you know, including myself, about their own books. And you think, oh God, you know, hers looks better than mine, or, you know, he's got more quotes than me,
right,
or she's a Sunday Times bestseller. You know, so it's really difficult not to fall into that rabbit hole of comparing yourself. But I try really hard not to, you know, not to let it affect me, because at the end of the day, like, this is, you know, it's your journey, it's your book, and you've got to focus on, you know, what's within your control.
Yeah.
So I think there are upsides and downsides, but on the whole, I do enjoy it. Although probably everyone's absolutely sick of me, like, tweeting about my book, but I sort of feel like you have to, you know, you've got to, I think the publisher sometimes expects it as well. And I think, you know, you've got to try and draw readers to the book, because otherwise, you know, you just get lost in a sea of books on Amazon that no one will notice.
Yeah, you just get in there and make as much noise, like you say.
Yeah.
A period of time, and then, you know, people move on to the next thing, don't they?
Yeah, definitely.
So
yeah.
On that note, if you just want to let the listeners know your Twitter address, they can follow you.
Yeah, of course. So my Twitter is Phoebe, which is Phoebe _A_Morgan. And I'm also on Facebook, which is Phoebe Morgan Author. And I'm on Instagram, which is Phoebe Ann Morgan. And I also have a website, which is phoebemorganauthor.com. So if you want to look on the website, there's sort of a lot of blog articles about writing and publishing and all the sorts of things we've just been talking about, which you might find interesting or not.
Perfect. Well, thanks ever so much for joining us on your publication day. And so
thank you.
Take a big deep breath now and go off and have a lovely day celebrating or whatever it is. You're going to have a glass of champagne or something later?
Maybe later, yeah. I'm having a launch party tonight. So yes, I think I'm going to have maybe Prosecco. I'll move on to champagne later. But yeah, thank you so much for having me on your podcast. Well,
thanks for coming on. I'm really looking forward to already reading your next novel. So really excited about that.
Thank you ever so much, Phoebe.
And it's been great talking to you. And thanks for coming on Sniffing the Pages.
Thank you.
See you again soon. Thanks.
Thank you. Have a great day.
So that's all for this episode. Katie and I are now going to go away and read our next books, ready to record for the next episode. We are reading The Migration by Helen Marshall,
The Snakes by Sadie Jones, and
Daisy Jones and the Six by Taylor Jenkins Reid.
And we should say that I think the next podcast will come out hopefully on World Book Day.
That's right.
Which is my favourite day.
Yes. You better go off and start making your costumes.
Yeah, absolutely. Which one of these characters am I going to dress up as for the day?
So thanks for listening, and we look forward to you joining us on our next episode of Sniffing the Pages.
Goodbye.
Bye.
The podcast you just heard was made using Anchor. Ever thought about making your own podcast? Anchor makes it really easy for anyone to get started. It's a one-stop shop for recording, hosting, and distributing podcasts. Best of all, it's 100% free. Sign up now at anchor.fm/new. That's anchor.fm/new to get started.